Welcome to Exagility. I'm your host, John Coleman.
Well, hello there. My name is Christian Verwijs. I'm one of the two founders of The Liberators, together with my partner, Barry Overeem. Been working with Scrum teams for a long time. I think it's almost 13, 15 years now. I have a background in organizational psychology, so an academic background, which I think we'll be talking about a bit more in this podcast. I'm also a professional Scrum trainer for Scrum.org, because that's a good place for me to bring that passion that I have for working with Scrum teams together. And now we're also bridging the connection with science.
Hi everyone, I'm Dr. Daniel Russo. I'm an associate professor of software engineering at Aalborg University in Copenhagen, Denmark. I'm mostly focusing in research about agile software development and other typical human-centered factors regarding the development of software.
Christian Verwijs, Daniel Russo, welcome to the Exagility podcast.
Thank you so much for having us. It's a pleasure to be here.
I was really struck by an article, I think it was by Christian on LinkedIn, tagging Daniel, because I believe the two of you were involved in a lovely piece of work. And it was a pre-publication labeled A Theory of Scrum Team Effectiveness. I was really struck by the image, and for those listening, we'll describe that in an audio way later on. I was really struck by it because it basically rang a lot of bells for me. But before we get into the details of the paper, Christian, where did the motivation for this all come from? Where did this all start?
I think it started actually a couple of years ago. Just for me personally, I've always liked to apply a scientific perspective to the work that I do. I think it's important that as practitioners that we also know what scientific insights say about our work. But there isn't that much of those insights that are being practiced in our work. At least that's my experience. I started to look for ways to actually start measuring some of the things I was interested in myself. So I started out with Team Morale, which is a simple tool. You can find it online. I think we can share the link in the show notes or something, where teams can measure their team morale. Well, a lot of teams found that super helpful. And I thought, okay, that's interesting. So what else can I help teams measure and diagnose? And that's when we started basically a bigger project at the Liberators, where we started gathering more data. And all that eventually has to do with how our Scrum teams, what makes them effective, what factors make them less effective. So that was the question that I started out with. I already started data collection. I think it'd been running for a year or 1.5 maybe. And then Daniel reached out to me by email. And I think that was 1.5 years ago or something, or maybe a year ago, Daniel. And
more or less, yeah.
Yeah. And you had a really nice offer, but maybe it's better if you explain the offer and what happened then.
Absolutely. So in my research community, I'm mostly dealing with empirical methods and especially structural equation modeling. And by then, actually, Christian had collected very nice data set about the relation, so the constructs, and then the relation among the constructs regarding agile software development. And since I was working by myself on similar papers, I was actually very interested in his data and to see whenever our belief of agile actually has an empirical validation. I guess this is the story why I reached out to Christian and how this all began.
And what was really cool about that moment where Daniel emailed me, I'd already started thinking about, can we somehow collaborate with academics, with people with scientific training, but I hadn't actually started looking for opportunities for that. And Daniel emailed me directly. And that was the starting point of the collaboration that created the paper that we're going to talk about. But what's also really nice about that collaboration, I think, and that's something that Daniel really brings to this, is there is already quite a lot of scientific research being done in organizations around Scrum teams, around agile work, but somehow those insights are not really reaching the community of practice. And I think that that's always, it's sad to be honest, because there's so much helpful work that we can rely on as practitioners, but somehow it's not finding its way to us. But also it's hard the other way around. So practitioners are not really reaching out to academics. And I think that our collaboration is maybe just one example of that. And I think that that's really cool. So I'm very grateful that Daniel initiated that.
I'm very grateful to you. I mean, it's super exciting. I guess that unfortunately academia has the tendency to basically be and consider itself almost like an ivory tower without more or less any duties to provide some insights to real people, to practitioners. And I think this is a pity because, you know, eventually, I mean, the way why we are paid by governments is because we are supposed to make an impact in technological advancements, in education, and so on and so forth. And it's not always the case, unfortunately, I have to admit. Yeah.
I'm curious about the data collection, right? Because that's a measurement that I would have done before. If you want to see if there's a trend over time, you kind of need to ask the same questions over time. But then the beast is changing as well over time. So sometimes you need to ask more mature questions, if you like, as the teams progress and so on. And there's also the whole idea of making sure that whatever questions that we're asking, that they stack up statistically, and there's a whole mechanics around that. And so how did you kind of work on that? How did you figure out that, you know, these are the right questions that maybe as you learned over time that you have to add in some things, but it's difficult because now you're trying to trend them. It's a bit tricky, isn't it?
It's very tricky, yeah. And maybe just John, if you measure things in your teams, how do you do it? Do you write your own questions? Do you go look for something? How do you normally do that?
I had to look at a few approaches. I looked at evidence-based management, for example, and that's helpful, but it's more helpful from the point of view of giving you some key value areas so that you don't kind of forget about them. Oh, I didn't think of that kind of thing. The logic model is quite useful as well from the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, where they've got inputs, resources, activities, outputs, outcomes, and impact. And again, though, that's still useful as a kind of a lens to see, have I forgotten anything? And then I think of Yves Morio's TED talk about the relay race. And he says, you know, we shouldn't be measuring the what, we should be measuring the how. And so I've kind of gone a full 360 on this, where before, you know, I used to be looking at outcomes all of the time. And then it was, well, teams weren't delivering outcomes, so they have a plumbing problem. So I need to figure out if they've got outputs to get some kind of sign that they're doing. But then I realized that sometimes if they're not even delivering outputs, well, how are they actually working? And it was kind of interesting. I had a very small data set, but I found high correlation between good discipline and for teams that were quite young, like less than 2 years, and having good outcomes. So I haven't really kind of landed. I'll be kind of playing around. I'm also looking at SenseMaker from the Kinevan SenseMaking framework, which is a way of kind of triangulating. Because according to Dave Snowden, he says that with Likert scale questions, you know, like strongly disagree to strongly agree, people kind of know what answer you're looking for. So, but if you give them a kind of a triangle and you give them three competing points, it's like you can kind of find, you know, you don't know what the exact right answer is, so you put the real answer in. Kind of. So I haven't really landed on it, but I have to answer your question. I have come up with my own questions, but I've also noticed that Mike Burrows has some stuff as well, an agenda shift, which is kind of less attached to which kind of approach you're using. It just so happens that when I'm working with teams, if they're already using a particular approach that suits them, I'll probably try to come up with questions that is related to their questions. So rather than having really generic questions, in this case it would be Scrum. If it was another case, it might be Kanban type questions. That makes sense.
Well, I think the theme in your response is basically that it's not easy to measure things correctly, right? And to measure them reliably. And I think that one of the things that we really wanted to do with our study is provide a measurement instrument that's reliable, that actually predicts important outcomes, and that also can be generalized across many different Scrum teams. My first job actually was for a company that developed professional surveys to use within organizations to measure employee satisfaction. So a lot of the work we did there was to create basically sets of questions to use, but also to go look in scientific research for what are actually good ways to measure, for example, conflict in a team or group cohesion or employee satisfaction. And I think a lot of that is actually trickling back into the work that Daniel and I are doing. Daniel, what's your experience with measuring? Because I think we both talked about that quite a lot, right? While writing the papers, how do you actually measure all these constructs that we're measuring?
I mean, absolutely. And if I actually might do a step back, and I think this also characterizes the almost uniqueness of this particular research, of this particular study. Because if we look in most, at least academic papers, let's say most of them are more or less case study, one or multiple experiences about the use of Agile in different settings. However, very, very few papers attempted to generalize those findings. And clearly, generalization is very difficult because you need a high amount of very diverse data, and diverse in the sense of not only one organization, but of multiple organizations, and possibly also different countries, different cultures, and so on and so forth, right? And especially the work Christian started has specifically this attempt. Now, as you guys mentioned, clearly, measuring is very difficult. There is an entire branch of science, especially in psychology, that deals with measurement. There are some specific statistical procedures in order to have a high validity in terms of the quality of responses. If you would like to go more into technical aspects, I'm happy to discuss, but I don't know if it's interesting for the general audience. Nevertheless, I think the important message here is to say that the data we have collected are extremely reliable. And I think that this has definitely to be stressed. And moreover, we are actually continuously working on it, for example, to make shorter version of it without actually losing reliability.
That's a good point. A good addition also. And I think we started out with the initial version of the survey probably contained 120 questions or something. These were all categorized into variables that we thought would be important for the effectiveness of Scrum teams. But we actually did many iterations to collect new data from a new set of Scrum teams and then see if certain questions were maybe misinterpreted sometimes or didn't really fit with the other questions. So we actually removed those, added new ones, even added new variables when we thought it made sense. So the whole creation of the survey was a very iterative process itself, as it should be, right? We're also figuring out how to actually measure this. And what we present in the paper is sort of the, I wouldn't say the final model because it's always evolving, but it's at least a model, as Daniel says, it's very reliable. And with it, we can measure, I think we somewhere use the metaphor of a telescope, right? It's like a gigantic telescope that allows us to see very small things, very distant, very far away from Earth with very high clarity. And I think that that's pretty cool about the research we've done and also the large sample that we've collected to base those findings on.
If I might also praise Christian, is that the amazing thing, and I mean, it's almost all his work, right? And I'm taking absolutely no credit in that. But, you know, I think the amazing part is that and this is probably also a unique aspect piece of a survey that, I mean, on one hand, it helps scientific advancements. But on the other, it's actually also very useful for Scrum teams to improve ourselves, right? So it's clearly a win-win tool, if you can call it this way.
Sure, yeah.
And for this reason, I think that actually also the Scrum teams that are using it are increasing every week. And it's amazing also to see how the practitioners community is getting engaged with it, is benefiting from it. And all this huge amount of data is incredibly valuable for the scientific advancement of Scrum and Agile practices in general.
Thank you, Daniel. And if we could move on now to the content itself in the pre-published paper, there was an image that really struck me, but we'll have to try to describe it in an audio way, where you had, for all intents and purposes, a number of variables, I guess, that were considered. And some of the variables seem to be kind of outcomes, you know, this might happen, so other things might drive this to happen kind of thing. Yeah. And there were other variables that seemed to be kind of almost like levers that you could pull or knobs you could turn to. Mm-hmm. If you could amp those up, good things happened kind of thing. So can you explain to us, Daniel, like how did you kind of convert this from kind of a whole set of survey results and all that kind of stuff into a kind of a model like this?
Thank you so much for your question. If I have 30 seconds of epistemology 101, I actually would like to explain to our listeners about how the scientific process works, right? So, I mean, more or less, we can say that we have two primary investigation techniques. One is an inductive one, where basically researchers are observing reality as it is and are basically making some inductions regarding, for example, some social phenomena like the relevant variables that are involved in a Scrum process. And after that, we have a deductive process or a validation process. So where through, typically speaking, statistical techniques, we are going to validate whenever they observe reality, what researchers think might be true or might be actually represent the actual reality, fit the data, the empirical data that has been collected, right? This is a very hard kind of work, because otherwise it takes several years, right? So I think that overall this whole research process took 7 years to complete. However, it has on the positive side that it's usually extremely reliable. How does it work? So typically in this specific case, and so there were a number, if I remember correctly, 13 case studies, and through iterative processes, some latent variables or categories have been induced, right? And similarly, also the relationship has been hypothesized. Based on that, we also looked into existing literature to see whenever or not, for example, our hypotheses were or not supported. Once we had an idea, actually a very strong idea of our theoretical model, so basically of our induced model, based also on other scientific evidence, we used actually the collected data from a survey to validate and to see if we had actually a good fit. And good news, short answer, yes.
Yes, absolutely. That's why it's super helpful to have Daniel here, because the way you describe this, how science works, it's super helpful for I think for our community, but also in the collaboration, we've talked a lot about this. So to summarize also, and to summarize the model also, we basically interviewed 13 well, a lot of Scrum teams in 13 organizations, and we created a model from that basically says that Scrum teams are most effective when they have happy stakeholders and when they have high team morale. That's what the teams said, right? It's not necessarily my opinion, although I do agree with it, but it's what we got out of those interviews. And those are sort of the outcome variables, right? If Scrum teams are doing a good job, if they're effective, then stakeholder satisfaction will be high, team morale will also be high. What we then said is, okay, one of the things that's very central to Agile and Scrum is that it's important for teams to release frequently. And we call this responsiveness in our model, which is a sort of a bit more abstract, which is the capability of teams to quickly respond to changing needs. And we measured that with a number of different variables. I won't go into that much detail for this overview, but just know that for all the variables that I'm discussing, we actually use variables below those to measure those as well. So responsiveness for us was one of the most important variables to make Scrum teams effective. But we also said there are other things that are important, and that's what we learned from the case studies. And the first one is that it's important for Scrum teams to also work closely with stakeholders. And we call this stakeholder concern in our model. And basically we say that when teams have a high concern for stakeholder needs, they will be more effective, right? So that's another effect that we hypothesized. However, we also hypothesize, and I think that that's personally the coolest part of our model, I think, and the research we've done is you need both. So it's not enough to be just responsive and be very quick in releasing but you also have to be very concerned about stakeholder needs. If you do one or the other, your team still will not become very effective. So you really need both. And I think for us as Scrum practitioners, we're immediately like, yes, that's why product owners are important. And that's why it's important to release frequently every sprint if you can. But the nice thing is that our model started just with what Scrum teams told us and the effects we expected from that. And then we tested that with a large set of data. Now, there are a couple of other variables that I can briefly summarize. Is stakeholder concern responsiveness are the most important ones for our model. But we also say there are basically three hygiene factors that need to be present in the environment of Scrum teams in order for them to be effective. And the first one is continuous improvement, or a climate of continuous improvement, where teams feel okay to try new things, to do experiments, where it's safe to fail. That's one of them. Another one is the autonomy that teams have to actually make decisions about how they do their own work. So this is partially self-management. This is also cross-functionality, because if teams are very cross-functional, they also have more autonomy and decision space on how to work together as a team. And the final hygiene factor we identified is management support. And I think that that's the one that we find most frequently in other literature as well on this topic. Management support is very important for Scrum teams to be effective, because they basically create the environment where all these other variables can prosper. Now, that's a super short summary of the model, and I'm sure there are things we absolutely need to say about this. But Daniel, is there anything I missed that you think is really important to add to the model?
No, I mean, I think that you provided an outstanding overview. I think that maybe we should also say is that the very cool thing, especially of structural equation modeling in general, so basically the statistical techniques that helped us or that we actually use to validate our observer reality, is that we can do and run a number of very nuanced and very specific analyses to generate many more insights compared to just inductive or case study-like observations.
So there's one thing that really struck me from your study, and it was continuous improvement. It just kind of came, that was the one, you kind of see what you believe, and so sometimes something that resonates with you kind of appears. And what I've seen a lot with Scrum teams is they do the usual things. They get trained up, they build a product backlog, they start the first sprint, and they start doing retrospectives, and they try to be creative about how the retrospectives are run, because people kind of can game the retrospective if they understand the format. So they try to, you know, normally if the Scrum Master is facilitating the retrospective, they'll try to come up with something different. But what I notice a lot is that despite all this retrospecting, a lot of these teams don't actually continuously improve. And it's almost like, we're there now, where we're doing Scrum, where we're going through the motions. And I've seen two aspects that I've seen. Almost like complacency amongst team members that we don't need to improve, but also maybe a lack of autonomy for the team as well to actually improve. Because a lot of the time, the improvements that are needed are outside of the sphere of influence, outside the control of the team, basically. But that doesn't stop me from asking a team to still try to come up with some improvements, tiny improvements within their own influence. So that really struck me. So when you were looking at continuous improvement, what were the key drivers that, you know, really supported the notion of continuous improvement really happening? Christian, what's your take on that?
Well, we actually measured a number of things. And for example, psychological safety is a really important factor that determines if teams can actually improve continuously, at least in our model, but also in the cases that we studied. If there's no safety for people to try new things, or they have to worry about being criticized afterward, they won't try anything, and then it's hard to improve continuously, right? And also what you mentioned, sprint retrospective quality, that's a really important one. And I think there's a lot more we can say about sprint retrospective quality, a lot more research that we can do into that one, but one of the things that I've always noticed myself in my own practice is what you say, right? So basically, Scrum Masters maybe do the same thing all the time. You use the same formats. But are you actually talking about the important things, about the important challenges that you're facing? And maybe just to connect it back to the model that we created in this study is, I think if the sprint retrospectives actually focus more on the factors that we identified in our model, it actually gives Scrum teams way more opportunities to improve. So rather than talking about, are we using Jira or physical whiteboards as our Scrum board or our product backlog, how is stakeholder concern in our team? How is the autonomy in our team? Do we have enough support from management? Are we actually improving continuously? Are we responsiveness enough? So if you focus your sprint retrospective more on that, I think it will also be very helpful for Scrum teams.
And when you look at management support, for example, what are you looking for there? Christian, what would be some of the key mini variables, if you like, that would maybe underpin management support?
Yeah, if maybe I might take this one, because I probably know also a short note on this. Before working with, I also worked for several years on a paper that will be published in a few weeks on ACM transactions auto engineering methodology, the so-called agile success model, where basically it takes into consideration which are the most relevant stakeholders and how they interact with each other in an agile process, and management support and especially top management support was a very, very, very important key factor. Now this actually isn't surprising as such. So if we look especially in management literature, we see that this is absolutely a driving factor in most of the cases. Organizations that are typically top-down, right? I mean, on one hand, especially if top management drives every kind of decision, clearly top management support is of absolute importance. But also a more flat organization, top management support is essential to create a welcoming environment. If we look specifically into so-called agile transformation processes, right? So basically an organization going through a more plan-driven to a more agile-like mindset, this is actually also very important. So we have a huge number of evidence telling us that in several agile transformation processes, companies or organizations do it because it's cool, right? So, and it's basically become part of the value that they are selling to their own customers. However, in most of the cases, it also happens that they are actually not really structured for it, or maybe they claim to be agile, although they are not, or they are also losing control. And in this particular case, creates a lot of anti-patterns that are actually detrimental for the success of agile projects.
Yeah, and I think there's a lot you can say about how management can support Scrum teams, but what we measured in our model specifically, and I would like to add more in the future if we can, but what we looked for initially was, to what degree do Scrum teams actually feel supported by management? So it's actually a question that we ask, like, do you experience support from management? Do they understand why you work with Scrum? And are they there to help you remove impediments? And I think that also gives direction to the role of middle and top management, is that that's, and we know this from a lot of other evidence, as Daniel already said, like that it's important for management to ask, to, rather than tell what to do, ask what they need. What do teams need? And that also fits with the team autonomy that we talk about in the model. Basically, management can ask, okay, what is impeding your autonomy as a team right now? What can we help you remove? And I think that that's the way for management to support Scrum teams. And that's some speculation on my part, because our research was not super detailed into what kind of support is necessary. But I think that from all the evidence that we already have from other studies, safe to say that this would be a good strategy.
Absolutely. Also because it's not, you know, there is actually not one specific recipe, because organizations are very diverse. Organizational routines are very different among themselves. So it has really much to be tailored. However, to specifically address your question, I would say it's an issue of environment. And as Christian said, it's not very much about what teams, it's not about telling teams what they are supposed to do, but actually asking teams what we need in order to remove possible impediments and also support and accept failure. That I think is also quite a crucial factor. Yeah.
And maybe just as an example of this, and Daniel just mentioned like how it's a win-win situation for scientific research and the community, what we're doing. What we're going to do in the coming months is to add to the Scrum team survey a way for teams to also invite management to basically rate on the variables in our model to what degree they are supporting Scrum teams in those areas. And we'll actually also give Scrum teams that feedback and also give management that feedback. It's all a way for us to create those conversations within organizations around where can management actually support Scrum teams. And the data we're collecting from this, we can then again use to help management find better ways to support Scrum teams, right? So it's a win-win.
Very, very curious about Daniel's work in the Agile success model, and just share something that's going on in my world, Daniel, and I'd love to hear your feedback. So
absolutely. I'm happy also to share you the link on that one.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you very much. We can put that onto the description as well. Thank you so much. So the thing that I'm finding with fairly senior Agile leaders, a lot of the things that Christian and yourself brought up are completely true in terms of, you know, helping to fix problems and creating the environment the team need and all that kind of thing. That's all really, really good. One of the key behaviors that I look for is that managers stop pushing work. What I mean by that is, you know, no problem with putting a new work item or asking a product or put a new item into a product backlog. That's like a list of things to be done. It's uncommitted. It's like a wish list, really. I'm oversimplifying now. But what I'm talking about is behavior where, you know, you need to start this today. And the team is already full up with work. They've got loads of work already. You need to start this today. We can say no to stakeholder X, Y, Z. And sometimes it's subtle. It's not so much a command. It's clear expectation and almost a campaign to take this work on. And the person receiving the request knows who's doing their performance review at the end of the year in terms of, am I as a team member being a big citizen and taking on extra work? Am I going above and beyond the call of duty and all that kind of thing? And so what I say often to Agile leaders is that really stopping push is like Agile and nappies. It's like, that's the first thing that you do. I don't have any comforting words for leaders who say, well, you know, we're not Agile yet and we're not ready yet and we're not really there. So, you know, we can just do this for another 6 months. We can keep pushing. And I say, no, you actually have to stop pushing. You have to wait on the team has the capacity, whether that's a Kanban team or whether it's a Scrum team. Well, for example, in Scrum, they've got the sprint and you're not really supposed to be bringing work in during the sprint. I mean, there are some edge cases around that, but not in general, no. And that's a kind of key behavior. And I'm curious, Daniel, if that's something that you've noticed in your work when you were kind of looking around the Agile success model, did it pop up at all?
Generally speaking, I'm not a big fan of, and clearly also not a big believer of specific receipts about do's and don'ts. I think that, again, it's each decision has to be tailored to each specific organization. Having said that, we definitely see and recognize some patterns, and this is probably also one of the most significant contribution of Agile success model in looking and seeing and also in understanding which stakeholder are actually most relevant for Agile project success. And what we see there, that actually development teams are the key leader to that. And they have, I don't want to see protected, but you know, at least there must be a very high degree of understanding within the organization about what teams are doing, which are their struggles, and how to support them. And in some specific cases, you know, also how to terminate teams and also specific projects that basically are not going anywhere.
Yeah, I'm curious to see that paper and really looking forward to that. I can't wait to... How long did it take you to develop that paper? How long did
it take? Several years.
Several years.
I think something like 5 years.
Okay.
It's a work that I started doing actually during my PhD. And it's one case study studying the agile transformation of the Italian army, about the development of command and control system that's also in use in military operation today, where, again, very similar actually to the paper Chris and myself have written. It has, let's say, an inductive part where I'm suggesting a theoretical model to understand agile transformation processes. And then a data collection where I try to see to fit basically my observations. And based on that, I also run a number of more specific and nuanced analyses to grab much more insights and evidence compared to just some variables and relation among them.
I find that very interesting. I was working in a large UK bank in 2015, and I was getting some responses from people that were regulated, were heavily regulated here, so we, you know, we can't be agile kind of thing. But there was a guy there, he happened to be in the UK Army Reserves. He was quite high up in the UK Army Reserves. And a lot of what happens in the military is quite agile, actually. And then, of course, I discovered later on Extreme Ownership, you know, that book from Jocko Willink and Leif Babin. And then, of course, Team of Teams. And so then what I was doing was I was pulling some of the principles out of those when I was in that bank, saying, you know, well, if they can do it, you know, we can do it. I thought it was an interesting kind of.
Absolutely. So I think that agile in, let's say, constrained organization is a very, very interesting thing to talk.
Yeah. It is nice, though, that that's sort of the stereotype that people often give us an example of an agile organization, right? That's the army. But if there's any place where people are confronted with complex work on a daily basis, it's the armed forces and the environments they operate in. So it makes sense that they're quite agile. And I think that that's something that's definitely you can take from the paper that Daniel wrote.
Indeed. And so stepping back, going back to your paper again, in terms of Scrum team effectiveness and the key variables that are involved, if you were to kind of pick some top tips for Scrum teams in terms of what they could take away from this report, what would they be?
Shall I just take two and then Daniel, maybe you can add two more. Is that a good idea? That we sort of share the tips, the tops and tips. My first tip would be to basically diagnose your team on these variables. And you can use the survey that we created for this. We'd love that. But if you don't want to, you can also do it another way to just have a conversation around it. For example, in your team, like, how are we doing on responsiveness? How are we doing on stakeholder concern? How are we doing on continuous improvement, team autonomy, and management support? From our research, we know that if those score high, your team will be more effective. So if you're scoring low in some of these areas, then there's probably work to do there. That would be my first tip, to diagnose the situation you're in right now. The second tip would be to actually, as a team, work together to identify improvements. If you're the scrum master of a team, or you're the product owner, or you're in a senior management position, and this is happening in your organization, these diagnoses are being done, don't come up with solutions for the teams. Instead, share the observation with the team, right? Maybe stakeholder concern is low. What can we do to actually improve that situation? And where do we need help? What help do we need from management? Be specific in the request for help that you give to management. I think that that's very, very important. So those are the two tips that I would give.
Actually, my tips are very much similar to Christian ones. So
that's anyway. Good. That's good.
Maybe I am providing here a little bit more context that might be of interest to some of our listeners. Although I'm not, as I said before, a huge believer of specific receipts and telling, you know, if you're doing this, you will be fine. And if you're not doing this, it will be horrible. And I think this is still true here. The model per se, as any possible model, has its limitation. And it's not the holy grail as such. Having said that, it's, at least from a scientific perspective, the most reliable tool we have available nowadays. One pity regarding the advancement in the professional community is that we are very much like almost anecdotal in terms of what works, what doesn't work. In some specific cases, I think this makes a lot of sense because, again, every organization is unique per se, and one thing that works in one organization might not work in another one. Having said that, I think that we should start using more generalizable tool to understand what's happening in our specific software development processes. And in that specific instance, I think that the tool, which again, I would also like to stress that it's absolutely free to use for any team. And if you don't want to use that specific tool, you're clearly more than free to use your own one. But first of all, you have to start to diagnose whatever works, whatever doesn't, in order to take specific action. The second aspect that I want to mention, and it's probably a more general one, probably also related to younger professionals, for example, like me. So I'm 32, so I'm still consider myself as a young professional, is need for autonomy. Need for autonomy is clearly very important for specifically speaking to agile software team. And I'm also doing specifically research into need for autonomy in a huge variety of aspects about agile and generally speaking about software development processes. And it's hugely relevant. And need for autonomy means mostly we are no more in a world where we are supposed to micromanage people or to be micromanaged from other people. And if I can relate it to myself, so I like, for example, to be creative and to find creative solutions to complex problems. But on the other hand, I'm also very bad in micromanaging, for example, my students or my staff in doing very little, very specific tasks, right? So, and it's also very tiresome for me, let's say, in a more managerial position to spend basically my time in following rules. And for this reason, adopting a huger level of autonomy, of trust, of its own employees is very helpful, not only for project success, but also probably for your own mental health as a manager.
Thank you very much, both of you, for your tips. I wanted to come back to Scrum now and then how it relates to your paper. And there's a couple of concepts that are really crucial. And one of them is definition of done, kind of like a checklist for how we do things around here. Considers technical standards and maybe product quality standards and so on. And also goals. So in the 2020 Scrum Guide, we now have a product goal, and the sprint goal is hopefully iterating towards that product goal. So if we start off with the definition of done, Christian, I'm just curious, you know, when you did this, did definition of done pop up at all for you in terms of did you notice anything in relation to definition of done? And what else did you notice about that?
Kind of wondering what would happen if I say, no, we didn't notice anything at all. It doesn't matter at all. No, it is actually in the survey. So we're asking questions about the definition of done that teams use, whether they have one or not, and whether or not teams actually talk about it frequently. But that's part of the variable for quality that we measure, concern for quality. And that's part of continuous improvement. So what we see is that teams that are very consciously thinking about quality and trying to improve it generally also do better on the other variables that are related to continuous improvement, like psychological safety, for example, shared learning, sprint retrospective quality. So definition of done is definitely part of that. As your mention of shared goals, that we do ask questions about that, like, do you have sprint goals? Is there a goal for your product, a product goal that you're working towards? And those are part of the stakeholder concern variable that we described. Because it all has to do with being able to explain as a team, why is the work that we're doing valuable? And why are we not doing other work right now? And why are we saying no to other work? Because we have this goal and that's what's important for us right now. And for us, and we can also see this in the data, that this connects closely to stakeholder concern and the other things we're measuring there, like are teams focused on value? Do they work closely with stakeholders? Because if you work closely with stakeholders, sprint goals all of a sudden start to make more sense. Product goals start to make more sense, but also sprint review quality, which also makes more sense if you have clear goals. So yes, clear goals, definitely part of the model and very important for the effectiveness of Scrum teams.
And just as a follow-up question then, I often talk about different types of team, like a layer of cake team and slice of cake team. I try to avoid using the expression component team, feature team, because they tend to get misunderstood. The metaphors break down, but most people kind of get layer of cake team. If it was software, for example, you could have a front-end team, middleware team, back-end team, non-software. You could have, I don't know, packaging, communications, you know, different layers, but they're not integrated. Slice of cake, we're kind of all in the one team and so on. And the Scrum Guide doesn't say we can't have layer of cake teams. And probably most of the teams in the world probably are layer of cake teams. And the Nexus pattern is a lovely way of kind of getting that slice of cake, even if you have layer of cake teams. So that's all good. But I'm just wondering, did that pop up in the survey in terms of how important the structure of the team was in terms of making a difference?
It did. I do have to say that we did not specifically measure whether or not teams are component teams or feature teams or layer. I like layer cake a lot more. I'm going to stick to that one. We didn't measure that specifically. So from the data, I can say if that's really a factor or not. What we can say is that we did ask teams questions about their cross-functionality, which relates, I think, strongly to this, which is the ability of teams to work together to create a done increment and to actually put their skills together. And that definitely seems to be important. Generally speaking, teams that release more frequently, and by release frequently, I mean something goes to production at the end of the sprint or very close to the end of the sprint. Teams that release frequently to stakeholders are more effective and they have higher stakeholder satisfaction, higher team morale. And I think it's going to be very hard for component teams to do that. That's an assumption, though. That's speculation on my part. But I think that the model at least makes it feasible or likely that the layer cake teams are more effective. But that's something to explore maybe in the future.
Thank you. It seems like you kind of got it through the back door anyhow, because yeah, you're right. If they're able to release frequently, whether they've got layer of cake teams or they've figured out a way to get that slice of cake, right? So
yeah,
I think you've got it. Yeah.
And I just want to applaud, because Daniel starts every answer almost with, I don't believe in recipes. I think that I should start my answers with that too, now that I think about it. But I think that that's maybe also important for this particular question. Maybe it's not so much if you're a layer cake team or not, because that's essentially sort of a recipe, but maybe it's more important. Are you actually capable to release to production to your stakeholders every sprint, or at least very frequently? If you can do that with non-layer cake teams.
I want to thank both of you very much for coming on the Exagility podcast. Just one final question. If you wanted people to kind of understand the key takeaways from the paper, Daniel, if we could start with you, what would they be?
Right. So first of all, I would like to stress that we put actually a significant effort in writing very easily readable summary of findings and implications. So if anyone is interested in the paper, sure, he can just go to table 5 and read those. And additionally to that, with Christian, we also have written, and I think it will be published in a few days, Medium post that anyway explains the paper in a way less technical way than clearly, I mean, an academic paper has to follow some specific rigor standards. If, therefore, I might answer your question with table 5, right? So basically with a summary of our findings and implication, we basically kind of developed and evaluated a so-called 5-factor team theory, where specifically for responsiveness, stakeholder concern, continuous improvement, team autonomy, and management support, we identified specific recommendations. And I would maybe also end stressing again that the actually best way to support your own team or your own organization is to use a diagnostic team like that Christian developed, or again, if you think that it doesn't really fit to your organization, develop a similar one. But it's always very good to have very clear in mind where are you right now and where do you want to go.
Well, my conclusion for at least for this podcast would be that, just to add to Daniel, is that yes, we've created this nice 5-factor model, which I think gives focus to teams and organizations on what to diagnose and where to focus their improvements on. It's just a model, and it's well based in data and case studies, but it's still a model. So it's not complete. There are things not in there, but at least with this model, we can predict a very substantial amount of stakeholder satisfaction and team morale. And I think that's really important for organizations to realize. So there are also things that are not in the model that are maybe not as important, but we're going to properly explore those in future research. So that's one thing that I would say. And also, just for the listeners, this research right now, it's being done by Daniel and me. It's funded by the patrons of the Liberators, because basically Barry, my partner at the Liberators, has been so kind to say to me, just go crazy with this. It's important that you do this. Go ahead. But that also means that my time on this is funded by work that we're doing and the patrons that are supporting that. And also the people that are subscribing to the Scrum Team Survey. So it's a free tool. Everyone can use it. But if you really like it and want to unlock some advanced features, you can subscribe. And that generates a small revenue stream, which is useful for me and Barry to sustain this work. And well, Daniel is already paid by the university, so that's a different story. But it would be great for us to continue this collaboration and generate more research that we hope is going to be very helpful to the community and to science. And finally, before I forget, we're also writing a non-technical version of Daniel's paper about the Agile Success Model, and that will probably be somewhere in the coming weeks. So there will be two non-technical versions of both papers available with the important takeaways summarized in a non-technical manner.
Thank you so much, Christian. Thank you, Daniel. Absolute pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you, John. And thank you for inviting us.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, John.
If you would like your voice message to be featured on a future podcast episode, please leave a voice message at anchor.fm/xagility/message. That's anchor.fm/xagility/message. Thank you.